I'm John Donvan, a correspondent for ABC News and ABC News Nightline, and your host and moderator for this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, Oxford-style debating brought to American shores. The motion is America is finally winning the war in Iraq. We are speaking and gathered at the Caspary Auditorium at the Rockefeller University in New York City. You will hear from four panelists on this motion, two who are for the motion and two who are against. This is a contest. This is a contest of persuasion. The goal of the panelists is to change the minds of this audience assembled in an amphitheater, several hundred of you who will come into this event with their minds perhaps not made up or made up. The goal of these people is to move your opinion. We will take a vote to see what your views are on this motion as you come in off the streets, but I first want to explain. The topic tonight is America is finally winning the war in Iraq. It's time now for our panelists to begin making their opening statements. And I just want to go back and remind people of where we were in 2006 when the war in Iraq was not going very well from the point of view of the United States and from the point of view of President Bush. He sought out a go-between, somebody who could make a trip out to the war front and come back and tell him whether victory was possible. The person he chose is our first panelist tonight, retired four-star general Jack Keane, who made those trips to Iraq and came back convinced that a surge was the way to go. General?
Thank you very much. My involvement in Iraq goes back to 2003 when I was on active duty, and I visited Iraq right after the invasion. And shortly left active duty, I joined Secretary Rumsfeld's policy board at his request with Henry Kissinger and Newt Gingrich and Tom Foley. And in 2006, I parted company with the administration and the Pentagon over the war in Iraq because I believe our strategy was failing. I took that message to Secretary Rumsfeld and also to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Peter Pace, and had devised a new strategy. And eventually, with others, and I may say others, that had some influence on the President of the United States to admit that the strategy was failing and it needed to be changed. I tell you that because I knew what failure looked like, and I also know what the word winning or success looks like. Most of the time that we go to Iraq every few months, about every 3 months for 2 weeks at a time, we spend most of our time with Iraqi people out on the streets where they are, in the schools, in their hospitals, seeing what life was like. In 2006, no children going to schools, hundreds of people being killed every week, people not going to their jobs, only going to marketplaces to seek provisions on an emergency basis, a country fracturing, heading towards civil war. It was not a civil war, and a possibly failed state. The conditions in Iraq today and gradually improving over 2007 and 2008 are a dramatic difference. All schools are open. The marketplaces are teeming. The natural rhythm of life is returning to the people of Iraq. The security situation dramatically improved because the mainstream Sunni insurgents who started the war have capitulated. Sheer extremism has had a major setback supported by the Iranians. And as time appears to be playing out for us, it appears that it's going to be a major defeat as well. The impact on the political process is extraordinary. There's a rising political class in Iraq that we have seen. Every place you go in Iraq, people are interested in the political process. There are 500-plus parties in Iraq. We struggle with these two that we have, to say the least. Can you imagine what it's like? The political reconciliation that has taken place in Iraq is very real. The most recent one is the provincial election law, which will redefine Iraq. It is a seminal event. Power will be shared. The people will get better services as a result of it. They will have their own budgets. They will have a place to express their grievances and their needs. Less than 3 years after this government took power, as inefficient as it has been at times and ineffective as it has been at times, when you draw back from it, it has been a remarkable movement towards what the premise is here.
Thank you, General Jack Keane, arguing for the motion. When a guy hits it big in software and then he sells his company to Microsoft for more than $100 million, and then he decides that he wants to start making movies, there's a tendency to think, well, maybe here's another rich guy with a vanity project on his mind, except that the movie that our next panelist made, it's a documentary on the U.S. experience in Iraq. It premiered last year and was almost universally reviewed as superb and serious and ultimately became a contender for an Oscar award. The title of his film tells you where he stands now very clearly. It is called No End in Sight. Charles Ferguson arguing tonight against the motion.
Why was this war fought? It was fought to remove the threat of WMD from Iraq and also from the region, to install a pro-Western democratic government. It was also intended to assist the United States in bringing economic, diplomatic, and military pressure on Iran so that it would stop developing nuclear weapons. The administration predicted that the cost of the war might reach $50 billion and that U.S. forces would probably be substantially withdrawn by September of 2003. So what happened? Not enough troops were used. Planning for the war began 60 days before the invasion. Ambassador Bremer, when appointed, before he had set foot in Iraq for the first time in his life, a man who had never served in the military, never overseen an occupation of any kind, on May 9th, 2003, he decided that he was going to issue a debathification order, which lopped off and purged for life the top 50,000 administrators and technocrats in Iraq. He then disbanded the Iraqi military, throwing 500,000 soldiers onto the street, unemployed, with no notice, who promptly formed the insurgency. Virtually nothing was done about the insurgency for quite a long time. Its existence was denied. And what did we see as a result? 4,000 Americans dead so far, $1.5 trillion spent, 100,000 Americans wounded, twice the official number, and an Iraq that is just destroyed. 25% of the population of Iraq is either dead or is displaced internally or is external refugees, the equivalent of 60 million people in the United States having left the country. But what if Iraq now, I hear you say, has this country become a paradise? No, it is not. Violence is down. It's down roughly 75%. We don't know exactly how much. People are haltingly able to go to school, to go to work now in ways that they previously were not. But the infrastructure of the country remains destroyed. By most indicators, it remains below pre-war levels in matters such as water supplies, sewage treatment, electricity, power generation. Iraq is still a more dangerous place and a more hostile place and a worse place for most people than it was under Saddam Hussein. That is difficult to achieve. But we managed.
Thank you, Charles Ferguson. I'm John Donvan, and this is Intelligence Squared U.S. Oxford-style debating. Fred Kagan has been universally described as the architect of the surge at the American Enterprise Institute. He put the words on paper and connected the dots and drew up the charts and put together most cohesively the argument that ultimately persuaded the White House that the surge was the way to go. Arguing for the motion, America is finally winning the war in Iraq, Fred Kagan.
Thank you very much. And without meaning to spend my time taking on directly the comments that were just made, I'm going to mention a couple of errors of fact. Electricity production is higher than pre-war levels. That is a fact. And life worse than under Saddam. Well, that depends on who you are. I am in full agreement with the assertion that the Bush administration planned for the war badly, conducted the war badly, lived in denial for years. I was on record for all of that time. I get it. It's also irrelevant to the point at hand. And it's unfortunate in our national discourse that we spend so much of our time refighting the issue of whether or not this was a good idea and not enough time talking about where we are, where we're headed, what our interests are, and whether we are likely to be able to achieve them, which is, from the standpoint of a decision maker, the only thing that matters. And particularly since President Bush will not be running for office again, the question of his wisdom or unwisdom is something that can be safely left to the historians at this point. So the question is, where are we now? And the question the motion has put is, are we winning the war? I would like to amend the motion to say, America and the Iraqis are now finally winning. Because one of the things that has gone unnoticed is that a tremendous portion of the fighting that was done over the past 18 months was done by Iraqis, including the 100,000 Iraqi security forces that came online in a year, trained in contact with the enemy, marched directly into the fight against the enemy, both Sunni and Shia, and defeated the enemy across the board with American assistance, of course. It was a remarkable thing. The question will be put, was this war worth it? I would submit that that's a slightly different question from whether we are winning or not, and we can parse the semantics of this any way you like. As a military analyst, which is all that I am, I can tell you the trend lines now are positive. The importance of the elections law that was just passed passed most Americans by. It is a watershed event. And I can tell that because I've had in the past few weeks conversations with senior politicians, Sunni and Shi, and before that law was passed, they were very grim and very gloomy, and so was I. After that law was passed, the nature of the conversations that I had with these gentlemen changed entirely. And they also all made to me an interesting point. They said, you know, Iraq will be a rival to Saudi Arabia, a rival in oil, and also a threat to Saudi Arabia because Iraq will be a democracy. And Iraq will pose a challenge to authoritarian regimes around the region. And Iraq will be aligned with the United States. They were telling me that. Now, I believe that that's true. And I think that if we are, in fact, headed in that direction and we can, in fact, make that happen, then this war will have been worth fighting. Thank you.
Sir Malcolm Rifkin has held the post of Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom and Defense Secretary, a combination that, in this country, the only figure I can think of to have comparably held the positions of state and defense would be George Marshall. He is a friend of the United States as a member of the Conservative Party who's been in politics for 40 years, a supporter of many American policies and the special relationship. But when it came to Iraq, he said no. He was against going in. He is against staying in now. And he will be arguing against the motion, Sir Malcolm Rifkin.
Thank you very much indeed for your warm welcome. Lyndon Johnson once said that was a sort of introduction which my father would have enjoyed and my mother would have believed. I'm conscious that I'm the fourth person to speak this evening, so I will say what King Henry VIII of England is reputed to have said to each of his six wives. Please don't worry, I don't intend to keep you long. I was at first concerned when I was asked to take part in this debate whether, as a British politician, I should be speaking in a debate about the United States. But I reflected that George W. Bush's closest ally in the decision to go to war was Tony Blair, and Britain and the United States share a responsibility for what has happened. I don't dispute for a moment that the surge to which the reference has been made this evening has been successful in military terms in reducing the amount of violence. I don't doubt that the insurgency itself may be slowly coming to an end and that fewer people are being killed on the streets of Baghdad than was the case in the past. But of course that is true of all wars. All wars gradually grind to an end in one form or another. This is not a war like Pearl Harbor, or like the war in Afghanistan after 9/11, or the first Gulf War to liberate Kuwait. You were wrong, General Keane, to say the Sunni insurgents started this war. They didn't. The United States, the United Kingdom, and the coalition started this war, and they had not been attacked when they chose to do so. Saddam Hussein has gone, and there isn't a person here who will be other than pleased to see him go. But, you know, we'd like to see Mugabe go without going to war in Zimbabwe. We'd like to see Kim Jong-il in North Korea go. And yes, it's true, Iraq may have a more representative government than it's had for many years. But it's not a democratic government. It's a sectarian government of finely balanced Shia and Sunni who, when they've not been slaughtering each other in the last 5 years, have formed a very, very uneasy coalition. And yes, fewer people are being killed. But by God, you know, that can rise again at any moment. We know that by the admission of President Bush, at least 30,000 Iraqis have lost their lives. And indeed, the Iraqi government say over 100,000 Iraqis have lost their lives in the last 5 years. We know that 4 million Iraqis have become refugees, half of them fleeing to other countries. 40% of the Iraqi middle class no longer live in Iraq. And as a consequence, the job of rebuilding Iraq is going to be immeasurably more difficult. And we know also that the coalition forces, mainly American, have lost over 4,000 lives. These are a heavy burden. But it's not just the internal cost that has been paid. Look at what has happened in terms of the wider situation. We know, for example, that the consequence of this war is that Iran, the most dangerous country in the region, has, thanks to the United States and the coalition, now become the most powerful country in the Gulf. The Iranians cannot believe their luck. Without raising a finger, Iraq, which was the state that was their main competitor in the Gulf, has been essentially emasculated for the foreseeable future. We know that Al-Qaeda, who were never allowed to operate in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, have been active, have penetrated in Iraq, and even if they are ultimately defeated, have already radicalized sections of the community and done enormous harm. But perhaps the most serious geopolitical problem that has flown from this ill-judged initiative and invasion has been that the real drama of the present time in that region is Iran's attempts to develop nuclear weapons. So when you talk about winning the war, one has to look at the overall cost and the overall benefits. And I conclude simply by saying this. At best, you can say we may be stopping losing the war, but we're certainly not winning it. And I simply remind you of the words said almost 2,000 years ago by Tacitus, the great Roman, when in comparable circumstances, he said, "They have created a wilderness, and they call it peace." That is our legacy.
Thank you, Sir Malcolm Rifkin, arguing against the motion. We have the results of your points of view with which you arrived for this debate. They are rather lopsided. Those of you who are for the motion that America is finally winning the war in Iraq represent 20% of you, 54% of you are against the motion, and 26% of you are undecided. And again, the point of the evening is to see to the degree to which those numbers can be moved by the quality of our debate. Now, we're going to move now into the mix it up section of the program. And at this point, I would like you to begin formulating the questions that you would like to ask. We have microphones moving through the hall. But I want to start with a question to Charles Ferguson. Charles, I heard you outlining why going to war in the first place perhaps was a mistake and why the war was prosecuted badly in its first stages, which is a separate question from now going forward. Is the U.S. winning or can the U.S. win? And I want to ask you, what would be victory from your point of view?
If indeed Iraq had been stabilized, if there had been, as almost every pre-war advisory study recommended, if there had been a larger number of troops, if there had been a large number of Arabic speakers, if there had been a large international constabulary force, if the country had had a transitional period of martial law, and then after that gave way to or was turned into something from a full democracy, which I think that most analysts think was quite unrealistic, but a soft dictatorship, something more like Egypt, say, that would have been, if not a victory, something that would certainly not have been a complete unmitigated disaster.
Fred Kagan, do you hear in that answer any benchmarks that you think are in the process of being hit?
I'm troubled by the notion that you can simply dismiss the entire question of whether we're winning or not by saying that the sunk cost is already so high that nothing we could do could conceivably make it worthwhile, which is rather an intellectual cop-out, in my opinion. Although I'm fully in agreement with you about the mistakes that were made, I believe that we have actually attained many of the goals that you've just laid out. we clearly have a disagreement about the facts. I do believe that Iraq is being stabilized, with all respect, Sir Malcolm. I do not think that it is likely that you will see violence suddenly explode again, unbeknownst to us, because when you make it your mission to go around Iraq on a regular basis and to see what's going on in the particulars, rather than having this conversation from 30,000 feet about Sunni and Shia who don't like each other and are killing each other and so forth, what you will see is that violence in a particular area results from circumstances in a particular area. There are larger issues, of course, but it is astonishing how fractal the complexity of this country is. What I would like to do is have a conversation with you region by region, area by area, and talk about what had been generating violence, why it's not there anymore, and why I think that it will not be coming back anytime soon in that form. And that is what we see on the ground. And we see a government forming that is increasingly seen as legitimate by its people, which is astonishing. We see elections coming up that have galvanized and excited the Iraqi people like few things before. And the astonishing thing is, having spoken with Iraqi political leaders, Sunni, Shia, and Kurds, they all think that efforts will be made to rig the elections. They all think that some of those efforts will succeed. And they all expect to abide by the results of the elections. In my mind, that's a very healthy understanding of what democracy is likely to be like.
Fred, let me bring Sir Malcolm, it sounds like you were contradicted there.
Mr. Kagan claims that winning the war is because the fighting may be coming to an end. Of course, there has never been a war in the history of mankind that does not eventually come to an end as the people involved exhaust themselves. The point that I have to keep emphasizing is that the sheer trauma, the sheer disaster that Iraq has been for the last 5 years wasn't just predictable, it was predicted. If you go into a country and destroy its government without its understanding the nature of that society, and if you remove an existing regime, you create a political vacuum. And in a situation where Shia and Sunni have been enemies for hundreds of years, it was inevitable that there was going to be this outburst of sectarian conflict. If the United States and the United Kingdom did not understand that or did not accept that, then they're even more culpable. So to say that now we may be in a situation where the fighting may be slowly coming to an end, and to see that as winning the war, as if somehow we can simply ignore what has come before,
General Jack Keane,
does not bear credibility.
General Jack Keane, for the
motion. The fighting coming to an end is a condition that enables us to make political and eventually economic progress. The political progress is dramatically real. Just listen to what this Shia-dominated government that Sir Malcolm just wipes away as not having any intention of building a better Iraq. This government has passed a debathification law which changes the very social fabric of life in Iraq. It's equivalent to our civil rights legislation, which took us 100 years past the end of the Civil War. It permits the Sunnis to participate in the full fabric of life where they were denied that participation by Paul Bremer and our policy back in 2003. The Shia-dominated government passed an amnesty law which will free thousands of Sunnis from jail who were trying to kill that government and return to power themselves. They have done that. Why have they done that? They made that decision because they know that they have to reconcile with the Sunnis and with those who wanted to regain power if they're going to have a future. Our objectives are pretty clear. We want a government in Iraq that is elected by its people. That has already taken place and will be reinforced by the provincial elections, which will further diffuse that and make it even a more powerful political model. We want a country that is stable and secure and capable of protecting its people. And that is taking place and is not a threat to its neighbors. We do not want it to be a haven for radicalism in the region, to be sure. We have a country that wants to be aligned with us, that wants a strategic political relationship with us that crosses education, political, cultural, and educational ties. They do not want that kind of a relation with the Iranians. They want it with the United States of America. Therefore, we will have the opportunity to have that kind of a strategic relationship with a duly elected government the only government of its kind in the region, an Arab-Muslim country that has a duly elected government and is aligned with the United States and is a clear buffer against a threat in that region, which is radicalism, and particularly in the Iranians. It already is a buffer, and it will be a greater one as this country continues to mature.
General, let me bring in Charles Ferguson. Charles Ferguson, General Keane just said, we want a government that is elected by its people, and we have that. Do you dismiss that?
I don't entirely dismiss it. There is some degree of reality to Iraq's democracy. But a few points. There are many countries in the world which hold elections, sometimes even elections that kind of mean something, Zimbabwe, for example. Transparency International hasn't announced its 2008 ratings yet. In 2007, the most recent year for which we have available, Iraq was rated number 178 out of 180 countries. Just about everybody with whom I speak says that the corruption problem has gotten notably worse since 2007 and continues to get worse. And the society is really, in many ways, approaching breakdown, even though by some measures, some very real, significant measures, it is improving. But, for example, have any of the refugees returned? No.
In fact, yes,
there
they
is
have.
A very that's, small number. There
that's
is,
Fred
a,
Kagan
there is
interrupting.
Still a net outflux of 10,000 per month.
What about that, Fred Kagan?
I'm sorry, that's just false. Refugees have returned. If you say, have any refugees returned, the answer is yes.
A tiny
if you
number.
Say,
on a net basis,
have,
they are still leaving.
Are people leaving? That's fine. We can have that conversation. But there have been refugees returning. There have been IDPs returning as well. This is a process that has been that is ongoing. And I'm sorry, you have to recognize that. This is not the case where people are still fleeing the country in droves and that's all that's going on. You've got movement back and forth. One of the most important things that's happened is that key leaders in Anbar who had fled because of the Al-Qaeda violence have returned. They have come back and taken up their traditional positions in society, which is one of the things that has allowed the creation of a new political dynamic in what had been the hotbed of the Sunni insurgency, and they are now participating in the Iraqi political process. Those returnees may be small in number, but they are incredibly important for the future of the country.
As your moderator, I'm hearing not just a difference of opinion on interpreting the facts. I'm hearing a difference of opinion on what the facts are. For example, the question of electricity. Either there is more electricity than before or there isn't.
There
which
is.
Is it?
Well, hold on.
There
Let's
is.
Just get this in perspective.
No one Sir Malcolm Rifkin's
No speaking. One is, I think, suggesting that there is more electricity than there was before this war began. All that Mr. Kagan and General Keane are saying is that the war which we were responsible for creating, which destroyed Iraq's infrastructure, which destroyed its schools and its hospitals and its electricity and drove millions of people abroad, all they are able even to claim is it's now beginning to go back to what it was before we started this war. Now, if that is the culmination of this terrible 5 years, it's not exactly something we can be proud of.
That's not what we're saying, and that is not the case. Electrical generation and transmission in Iraq is higher, in fact, significantly higher than it was before the war.
It is, in fact, that is true. It is, I'm sorry, I did make one misstatement. It's about 30% higher than it was before the war.
Charles Ferguson.
Most other indicators, most other quality of life and infrastructural indicators, the availability of water, the availability of sewage treatment, the availability of education, et cetera, remain enormously below their pre-war levels.
We have several hands up, and I want to bring the audience into the conversation. Question from the audience?
I'd like to ask the For the Motion group to comment on some of the scary statistics around the flight of professional and middle class, and what do you see as the facts and the reality today of where the country stands, and then how does that evolve or correct itself going forward as the country rebuilds?
Jack Keane.
Actually, I'm going to start on this one.
Fred Kagan, his partner, will go first.
It's interesting. I just had this similar conversation with a senior Iraqi military leader. He made a point that the flight of the middle class in Iraq and the technocratic class began, in fact, with the rise of Saddam, when you had a tremendous number of highly educated people flee the country. Are those people coming back? On the whole, no, they're not coming back. Will they? It remains to be seen. What's going on is the formation of a new government in Iraq. It certainly was set back by mistakes that we made early on, the excessively harsh de-Ba'athification policy. What we are seeing now is the construction of a new Iraqi society. This will take a long time. And I think part of the problem that we have in this discussion is that we tend to conflate the question, with, are we winning, with the question, have we won? The truth of the matter is, we are winning, with respect, Sir Malcolm, not just in the matter of military arena, but in respect to politics and also now, finally, economic development. We are moving in the right direction. We do see the formation of Iraqi bureaucratic class. We do see the development of Iraqi technocrats, small in number, ineffective in some respects, still learning the ropes as they develop a new system, but we are making progress. We will have achieved, when we have achieved the aim of having this all worked out, we won't be winning, we will have won.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores.
Arguing against the motion, Sir Malcolm Rifkin.
Well, I think that there are always going to be good consequences of bad wars, just as there are sometimes bad consequences of good wars. What you've got to do is come to an honest judgment as to where the balance lies. Have the sacrifices been worthwhile of the Iraqi people, of the American people? Is the net effect of this terrible 5 years something that was worth doing in the first place? If the answer is no, it wasn't, then the fact that there have been some benefits, sure, that always happens even in the worst wars for the worst reasons.
Your comment on sacrifices raises for me the question of the price that has been paid in blood. And I want to ask, with as much sensitivity as possible and as much honor for the families of those who have lost soldiers, Charles Ferguson, did those men die for nothing?
I think it's worse than that. I think it's much worse than that. I think that history is going to record George Bush as one of the most horrifically arrogant, rigid, stupid, inhumane morons we have ever. In my film, 6 minutes into my film, there is a clip of a very intelligent, accomplished man who was the chairman of the National Intelligence Council from 2003 to 2005. He began performing intelligence estimates of the insurgency. And he gave them to the highest level of the administration. And he said that what he found most revealing was that President Bush not only had not read the estimate, but had not even read the one-page executive summary.
Would victory vindicate those deaths?
Victory would. In 1972, when he was first visiting China, Henry Kissinger asked Zhou Enlai whether, in Zhou Enlai's view, the French Revolution had been a success. Chou En-lai's response was, it's too early to tell. Now, by that standard, maybe we're winning.
Fred Kagan, can you take on the question of the sacrifice?
It is too soon to tell. The funny thing about a war is that it's not over until it's over. And what seems like a good idea in year one can seem like a very bad idea in year three, can seem like a very good idea in year 10, can seem like a very bad idea in year 50. And that's why you can't make a permanent decision and stamp it in stone, as those speaking against the motion would basically like to do. They'd like to say this: the sunk cost in this war is so high that nothing that could conceivably happen would be worth it. Therefore, the war was a failure and a loss. The problem is that's the story doesn't end there. The question is, what will happen in the years to come? And we don't know. Right now, it appears to me that the trends are positive. And what impresses me is that it is Iraqis who are engaged in this process actively who are saying so. And this isn't, I'm not talking about Ahmad Chalabi and other folks like that who've been discredited. I'm talking about people who are actually engaged day to day in running their country. This is what they're saying. If that is in fact the case, and I think that it is, not only will those deaths not have been in vain, as no military deaths are, but they will have served a tremendous interest of the United States of America and the world.
Thank you. That was Fred Kagan speaking for the motion. I'm John Donvan. This is Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. We have four panelists on the program, two for and two against the proposition. America is finally winning the war in Iraq. We are in our Mix It Up section, in which we are taking questions from the audience, and I understand that we have an Iraqi war vet who's had his hand up for some time, far in the back. Sir, the mic is yours.
Thank you. My name is Jose Vasquez. I'm a former staff sergeant in the U.S. Army. I'm also a member. Thank you. I'm also a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. My organization just recently published a series of testimonies called Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan Eyewitness Accounts of the Occupations. Over 150 members came forward to testify about the ongoing torture and corporate pillaging. My question for the folks that are for the motion is, given the systemic nature of these types of atrocities, do the panelists for the motion support a military victory at the price of moral and legal failure? Is that victory at all?
The factual basis of atrocities which exist in all wars as it pertains to Iraq are far lower than any experience that the United States have normally had in wars in the past. And I'm not suggesting they don't exist. They exist. The difference is this also, is that when the United States and its Western allies, when their soldiers do wrong and harm others, there's accountability for that. Those soldiers and those leaders that are involved in that are brought very quickly into a judicial process for accountability. That's what a democracy does, and that's what we have always been doing throughout our history. We're not perfect in this. That is the realistic issue here, is the fact that they have been committed, but they are much lower than our experience has been on a per capita basis, and always there's been accountability.
Thank you. We're going to go to another question in the rear.
My name is Ross Sandler. I'd like to look to the future a bit and ask both groups, what events or circumstances or milestones or trends would cause you to moderate your view?
I love that question. And it's what I asked before of Charles. What would be victory? When would you say, well, I might have been wrong, it's working out? Or the reverse, I might have been wrong, it's not working out. Jackie.
Sure, I'll start it off. Fred and I are not suggesting that there are not challenges ahead in Iraq. Of course there are. But the good news that we are bringing to you is that there's been significant progress here, and we've moved into another phase. We're moving out of a security phase into a political phase where people are using the political process to address their grievances as opposed to armed violence. And that's what we have to be hopeful for. I don't think that could be turned back easily. And certainly the second thing that would concern me are the Iranians themselves. They are up to huge mischief here. This is of a significant strategic interest. Their number one strategic interest in Iraq is the removal of the United States. They want a weak central government in Iraq so that they can have influence over that government. We believe, because of the anti-Iranian attitude that is in the South among its people and their commitment to move to a greater Iraq, aligned with the United States, that we will be okay. But if you ask me, am I concerned about it? I am.
Sir Malcolm.
General Keane rightly says that the Iranians have a strategic objective of wanting to see a very weak Iraqi government in order that Iran will be the unrivaled power in the region. He conveniently forgets or ignores that Iraq did have a very strong central government, not just under Saddam Hussein, but for the last 50 years under successive Iraqi governments. It is because of the war that he is supporting that Iraq as a strong centralized state has been destroyed, and that Iraq today has exactly that weak decentralized government with a Kurdish autonomous region in the north, with the Shia and Sunni constantly battling for influence and power, and with a central government having little real power. That is exactly what the Iranians wanted to achieve, and it is American and British policy that has helped them achieve it.
Sir Malcolm, are you saying that the war makes victory impossible?
I am saying that the only way in which you can test whether victory has been achieved is not to simply look at whether the insurgency is going up or going down, as if the war is simply about the insurgency. The war is about the invasion of Iraq, the destruction of a regime, the creation of a political vacuum, and whether the overall effects of that strategy, pursued by America, by Britain, and by the coalition, whether that has been a net plus for the Iraqis and for the region, or whether it has been a net minus.
Fred Kagan.
What would make me change my mind about the analysis? If the provincial elections are not held, are not seen to be legitimate or badly marred by violence, that will be a very negative indicator, and it will make me revise my view. If the subsequent Council of Representatives elections are not held, are not seen to be legitimate, or are badly marred by violence, that will be a very important negative indicator. If the Sunni Arab community in Iraq decides that it is not going to participate in the political process in these elections, in subsequent elections, or in any way thereafter, that will be an extremely negative indicator, and we'll have to revise our view. If the Iranian-backed and controlled special groups are able to reestablish themselves in a coherent fashion throughout the country and conduct the sort of coherent, widespread campaigns that they were able to conduct before the surge, that will be a negative indicator. If al-Qaeda actually returned and reestablished significant safe havens, I would say that that was an extremely negative indicator. And lastly, if large-scale, as distinct from periodic, as I say, smaller-scale violence and terrorism, if large-scale violence between Kurds and Arabs erupts, that will be a very negative indicator. Right now, I would say I'm most concerned about the elections, about their legitimacy, particularly of the COR elections after we've drawn down even more forces. I think the reestablishment of special Iranian-backed special groups is ongoing, and we will have to see how that plays out. The other indicators right now seem to me to be pretty positive, but I think those are the things that I would look at to evaluate as we move forward.
Thank you, Fred Kagan. And that concludes our Q&A section. I want to remind you once again of the numbers. We're going to reminding you that coming in, 20% of you, that with the motion, America is finally winning the war in Iraq, 20% of you were for the motion. 54% of you were against the motion, and 26%, nearly a quarter, more than a quarter of you were undecided. We're now going to move to final statements by each of the panelists. The first speaker to offer a summary statement will be Charles Ferguson, director and producer of the award-winning Iraq War documentary, No End in Sight. Charles Ferguson.
Let me begin my concluding remarks by answering the last question that was asked about what would constitute victory. As has already, I think, been made clear, Sir Malcolm and myself both share the view that we've long passed the point at which anything approaching victory really is achievable. But let's suppose for the moment that we magically forget about all the damage done and we simply focus on starting at this moment. If it were possible for all U.S. troops, not just the 25% that are combat troops, all U.S. troops to return from Iraq, for that to occur with Iraq remaining stable and without further violence, if the 5 million Iraqi internally displaced persons and external refugees then returned to Iraq, if Iran abandoned its pursuit of nuclear weapons, and if Iraq gets just to number 150 in the corruption index, I would consider that we would have made enormous progress. Nobody believes these things are going to occur. Nobody. Nobody.
Charles Ferguson. Summing up for the motion, General Jack Keane, a retired four-star general and former Vice Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, a member of the Secretary of Defense's Policy Board, summing up for the motion, America is finally winning the war in Iraq.
We have admitted openly that we had a failed strategy in Iraq for 3+ years, but we do have a winning strategy now. I look at Iraq as an opportunity. It is clearly in the United States' national interest to have an Arab Muslim country with a duly elected democratic government aligned with the United States in a region of the world, like it or not, that we will spend the next 30 to 50 years involved in, and it will continue to be ideological and serious struggles there. This is a step forward for the national security interest of the American people to have that kind of a relationship with a stable government. We are not there yet, but the signs are clearly there. And with the investments that we are making in resources and in certainly with our soldiers' commitment and, yes, with their lives, that is absolutely worth the sacrifice, in my judgment. There is not a single Sunni Arab state that surrounds Iraq that will not change as a result of a stable, duly elected democratic government in that country. And the Iranians will have to change and be influenced by it as well. And that is the opportunity that is in front of us. And regardless of all the mistakes in the past, that is in front of us right now.
Thank you, General Keane. Summarizing his position against the motion, Sir Malcolm Rifkind, former Foreign Secretary and a former Defense Secretary of the United Kingdom. Sir Malcolm.
General Keane has just said that in his view, what might be achieved in Iraq is worth the sacrifice that has been made. I think, you know, that's a very easy challenge to test. I think we just have to ask ourselves if 5 years ago we had known that by going to war, over 100,000 Iraqis would die, the internal economy would collapse, the Shia and Sunni communities would get into sectarian conflict, and we would have helped make Iran the real power in the Gulf. Would we have thought that achieving an Iraqi government which was elected, but which is not a true democracy yet and may never be, that that was on balance a sacrifice worth making? I don't believe that the 100,000 Iraqis who have died or their families who have survived them will believe it was a sacrifice worth making. The fact that they may now have a government which is better than Saddam Hussein, but what a terrible price they have paid for it. And we know that we're not going to invade any other country, knowing what now we know happens when you carry out such a strategy as we have carried out in Iraq.
Thank you, Sir Malcolm. Finally, summing up for the motion, America is finally winning the war in Iraq. Resident scholar in defense and security studies at the American Enterprise Institute, Fred Kagan.
This issue is too important for us to continue to be the bird that flies backwards, always looking at where it was and never looking to where it's going. And I'm deeply distressed by the tendency in our political class, our political discourse, and unfortunately the presidential race as well, to focus again and again on refighting mistakes that every single person up here agrees were made. The issue is not, did we make mistakes? The issue is, where are we now and where are we headed? And that is what we need to focus on as a nation, because the world will not stop and stand still while we flagellate ourselves, or as some of us flagellate others, for mistakes that were made, and we cannot go through the entirely self-referential exercise of beating ourselves up for what we did wrong and assume that the world will wait till we get through that and then do something. The stakes are too high, and we can't have a conversation like that.
Thank you, Fred Kagan. So now we see how this turned out. Once again, we'd like you to turn to the keypads and reminding you what our motion is: America is finally winning the war. And within a few seconds, actually, we will have the results. Ah, interesting. We've had some movement. Before the debate, to remind you, 20% were for the motion, 54% were against, and 26% were undecided. The motion for moved more of you. 36% are now for the motion. 53% are against, 11% remain undecided. So while the majority view remains against, more people's minds were changed by the course of this debate in support of the motion, the U.S. is finally winning the war in Iraq.
This Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, presented by the Rosencrantz Foundation, was held on the campus of the Rockefeller University. Robert Rosencrantz is chairman, Dana Wolf is executive producer, Maureen McMurray is radio producer, Damon Whitmore is the audio engineer, and I'm your host, John Donvan. For more information or to purchase tickets to future events, visit www.iq2us.org. That's IQ, the number 2, US.org. To hear the full unedited version or to sign up for the Intelligence Squared podcast, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. Intelligence Squared is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.